Good morning. You're listening to Running on Air, produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Don Merrill. Running on Air is a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. In this episode, we're talking with candidates from District 2. We want you to join the conversation. You can call the air room with questions for candidates at 503-231-8187. Or you can message a question on the website, kboo.fm. And you can also email us your questions at runningonair@kboo.org. Okay, let's meet the candidates. This morning we have four candidates in the studio for District 2. They are Nat West, Mike Marshall, Bob Simrell, and Michelle DePass. All of you, welcome. Thank you for coming.
Good morning.
So I guess the first question I wanted to ask you is, I noticed before we started this interview that all four of you seem to know each other. It was very cordial conversation with each other and talking, sharing pictures of your children. That's not something you expect to see in politics. First of all, how do you all know each other? And you do all know that you're competing for the same seats.
Yes, I'll start with a response to that. We all do know each other. We've been at multiple campaign events together. And because our form of the way that we're voting in Portland has changed, it has resulted in more collaboration between candidates. We also aren't competing for the same seat. There will be three seats in each district, and there's 22 people running in this district.
Right. There's 22 people for three seats.
But it is competitive, yes.
Right. Okay. Mr. Marshall.
Exactly what Michelle said. We spend a lot of time together. I joke that I spend more time with these guys than with my husband these days. And I've been around politics a long time. Most of my adult life, I've been in and out of electoral politics. But I've never seen a race like this. I've never run before. But by nature of the fact that strategically, it makes no sense for me to attack Michelle or to attack Bob, because everyone who's going to vote for them, number one, I want them to pick me as number two. And so the Charter Review folks designed a system to sort of take the acid out of our politics. And to date, I think it's worked really, really well. The other thing I want to say, though, is the nature of the people running, I'm probably the most political or have the biggest political background of anyone. We attracted, I mean that in a positive way. Like, I'm a recovering hack, right? Like, but we have attracted good, decent people who are really focused on North and Northeast Portland. They're not running to be in the legislature or be governor someday or whatever. It's not 22 ambitions that are competing right here. It's 22 Portlanders who love Portland.
Mr. Simrell.
Hi there. Thanks for the question. I think that one of the things that I'm seeing in interacting with these folks, first of all, high quality individuals that really care and love the city. As we go to 12 folks on the council, the thing that I lean into is the unique skill set that I bring and that each of us bring. Because as we build out this new form of government with the form of urgency, we do need a collective and collaborative approach to solve the problems. 70% of Portlanders are very frustrated in leadership here in Portland. So when we hit the ground running in January, we need to work together.
And Mr. West.
Yeah, I spent 12 years working in the local beer industry. And Portland beer industry is the most collaborative industry that I've ever been a part of. It was always, rising tide floats all boats. And, sure it's competitive, as Michelle said, but I want to compete where everyone is running their best game. So, we're all constantly trying to up each other and make sure that we're bringing our best candidates to the race.
Now, not all of you are native Portlanders. I wanted to maybe touch a little bit about touch on that a little bit, and your history in Portland or your history being in Portland. I'll start with you, Mr. Pass.
Thank you for that. Yes, I was born in Portland, and I've lived in many other cities around the country and the world, but I am rooted here. I've been here for over 50 years, went to school here, high school. I've been in District 2 the entire time, and I have a really long view of the history, particularly in Albina, mm-hmm. where I currently live.
Okay. Mr. Marshall?
12 years ago, my husband and I, we'd been dating for about a year or two and living in San Francisco, and decided we wanted to spend a life together and we wanted to find a new home together to start fresh. We're both in recovery. We met in a church basement at an AA meeting. And so coming to Portland was about us reaching for something great and beyond what we had. And we've never looked back. We love it here. We live in Irvington, and it's really, it's our home. It's absolutely positively our home.
Mr. Simrell.
Yeah, so graduate of Grant High School, class of 76. Don't do the math, it'll blow your mind. But before attending Grant High School, I lived in the projects outside of Compton in the 60s. And so as a black kid with a white mom, we had some challenges and struggles, but I also always persevered. I ended up at Grant High School in 76, and my dad got a job as a janitor at Lewis and Clark College, and I was able to attend tuition free. So I was the first in my family to go to college. And ran the Black Student Union, played baseball there, and then left after graduation up and down the West Coast, but relocated my family, where my two youngest kids also went to Grant. We came back about 10 years ago.
And Mr. West.
Yeah, I've been here for about 22 years, lived in the same house in the Woodlawn neighborhood for 20. That house is where I started a cider company 12 years ago in my basement. So my connection with Portland is somewhere in the middle between these folks, but it's definitely my home, and we're not moving out anytime soon.
Broad range of experience, broad range of locations, and so I want to ask you, each of you now, why are you running, Mr. Pass?
Yeah, I'm running because I believe in the promise and potential of Portland. I've a longtime resident and someone who chose over 30 years ago to be here where my family is. I've seen the challenges that we're facing. I think I have a good handle on what's happening at the city. I've been a city employee for off and on for about 30 years in three different bureaus, parks, planning and sustainability, and housing, and have seen at each of those bureaus things that I would adjust if I had a leadership position. And want to Portland to succeed, not just for today, to solve the problems we have today, but really to start thinking about the future of Portland and what type of city, who are we going to be in 50 years?
To follow up on that, you have been a city employee for a long time, so you're saying that there are things that you will be able to do as a city councilor that you were not able to do as a bureaucrat?
As an employee, I'm not a decision maker, and with this new form of government, the policy decisions will rest with the council. That said, I won't be able to do anything by myself. I might have the best ideas in the world. The ability to get those ideas implemented and across the finish line will be dependent on my ability to collaborate and compromise with my colleagues on the council.
Mr. Marshall?
I'm running because, as I said earlier, I just love Portland. But I don't love that our neighbors are living in squalor on the streets. I don't love that the drug overdose rate has gone up so exponentially. And I don't love that we have an addiction problem that is going unresponded to. I'm a person in long-term recovery. I run an organization called Oregon Recovers, which I launched, co-founded 7 years ago to try and address the state's addiction crisis. And I know clearly what we need in terms of not just one sobering center, but four sobering centers. We need to triple our detox capacity so we're not turning people away in the morning. 50% of the people got turned away this morning that were seeking help. That's ridiculous.
This morning. I see that you told the Portland Mercury, you said, I was raised to believe that when you see something, don't just say something, actually do something.
Yes.
So, and you also said, I love, a lot of loves here. I love that we are reinventing our local democracy.
Exactly. I'm a democracy geek. When the Berlin Wall came down, I spent 5 years working overseas on democratic development programs. I love that we're moving to that Portland once again is at the forefront of the country in terms of democracy reform. We're reinventing our democracy, and I want to get in there and really focus on the things that will reconnect people to their government and reconnect government to solving our problems. So legislative oversight, which doesn't exist currently, holding hearings, not gotcha hearings, like why aren't you doing this, but working with our great city staff and saying, okay, we had these five objectives for your bureau. Two of them are being met, but we're halfway through the fiscal year. Three of them we're not doing well on. What do you need? What's wrong?
Mr. Simrell.
So about 4 years ago when the Black Lives Matter movement started, a group of men and I got together and we started walking the city of Portland. And we've walked every Sunday about 5 to 8 miles, starting points all over the city. And so we've walked over 1,000 miles. And in that experience, you see a wide range of the fabric of the city. And when you, you hear the national media amplifying the negativity around Portland, but you actually see hot spots, but the rest of the city is doing very well. And so that narrative actually encouraged me to lean in. But then in addition, piling onto what Mike said, I agree this new form of government is exciting. I've never run for public office. I've been in private organizations my entire career. I have a skill set that I bring that I think will absolutely move things forward from the standpoint of performance, productivity, measurements, accountability, transparency, collaboration, results. Working with companies, you know, throughout my career, like Coca-Cola, Microsoft, I ran global sales for Tony Robbins, and I've run my own businesses. So I think that enterprise approach with this restructured government is going to give us an opportunity to produce results. And so that's where I'm going to bring my skill set in.
One of the things on your website that you mentioned is you focus on empathy and accountability. You call it a people-centric approach. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, so I do have a family member who's also is a lifetime addict, prostitute. You know, when I watch the pattern of this individual throughout their life, the up and down cycle of addiction and in and out of addiction and prostitution and so forth, she did better when she had structure, when she had resources around her. So I believe we have to absolutely wrap our arms around folks that are suffering from addiction, and we need them to lean in and participate in what I call saving their own rescue. So that's how I would refer to that.
Mr. West.
Yeah, I hear a lot of everyone so far is saying that the future of Portland, they want to help craft the future of Portland, and there is no one future of Portland. There, and that's what's exciting about this race, is that so many of us are more specialists than we've ever seen council candidates run in the past. Most council candidates running in the past are generalists. And there are many ways that Portland is going to be better in the future. And, you know, recovery is one of them. And you know, knowing how things work on the inside of the city to improve them is one of them. And I think a really important one is small business. We have created an international reputation for being a very small business forward city. And you can't find a small business owner in Portland who has good things to say about local government. And I think that as we look at, you know, what can small business bring? Well, obviously economic vitality, but culture as well. Are we going to turn into a city full of Shake Shack and Crumble? No, I think we're going to maintain our small business excellence, and that can be a huge magnet for our economic revival.
Well, I noticed what you told the Portland Mercury, talking about, you know, not a lot of faith in government. You said in the old system, you could basically buy yourself a commissioner if you had enough money.
That's right.
So you feel that this new structure of Portland, well, that brings me to the relationship between the city and the county. So what do you think as a counselor you'll be able to do to improve the relationship with Multnomah County, which right now is not really very good?
Yeah, I think one of the big things that we hear about when we hear about the difficult relationships is the Joint Office of Homeless Services. When that was set up, there was just a money transfer, and there was no guarantee or there was no requirement about improving lives with that money transfer. Since then, there have been a number of metrics that have been developed, but we continue to not, you know, I think we have greater oversight of our own bureaus than we do over the Joint Office, and yet we continue to fund the Joint Office without any real demand that the situation improves. I hear from the Joint Office in their newsletters that they send out, I hear, oh, we're really excited about the new intergovernmental agreement. Great, we got to have that. But I would be more interested in how many people are living on the streets now as opposed to last week. So that relationship, obviously there's interpersonal communication that we will all work on, and we're all pretty friendly with each other, so maybe we'll have good relationships with Multnomah County commissioners. But I think it all really comes down to data, holding people accountable with actual metrics.
And of course, a lot of that has to do ultimately with political will.
Sure. There's a whole new set of, mostly new set of commissioners who are going to come into Multnomah County. I think it's going to be in November. I think it's going to be an opportunity to reset some of the relationship. It's an open opportunity for us all to lean into that relationship.
So a caller named May called in. She had a couple of questions. So I'm going to ask this question for all of you. What is an issue that you really care about? What's your key primary number one issue, Ms. DePaz?
I have two issues. Of course, housing is on every Portlander's mind. And I having worked at the Housing Bureau, I would say housing affordability. So we have a spectrum of need, and we need to have a spectrum of solutions, a continuum, if you will, from the visible homeless that we see on the street to the people that we don't see that are also homeless, that are living in cars, RVs, or on people's couches, to families moving here that can't afford to buy their first home. I'd like to focus on a couple of things. One would be preventing homelessness through additional dollars in rental assistance, which we have the program right now, we could expand that, and to buy down housing affordability for working people.
Mr. Marshall.
So my expertise that I bring into this is about addiction policy as well as lived experience of being in recovery 16 years. But I think we really need to start looking upstream from that. And I just want to say I agree with everything Michelle just said about housing. But if we look upstream from that, 12% of the people, the children that live in District 2, live below the poverty level. That's the federal poverty level. So you know it's a higher percentage actually in meaningful. 20% no food insecurity, 40% no housing insecurity. That's the incubator for addiction, for mental health, for incarceration. And until we start focusing on how, and we know from COVID how to cut the child poverty rate. This country cut the child poverty rate in 18 months by 50%. Most successful government program in history by simply giving cash to parents who knew what was best for their kids. And so we need to be looking at innovative ways to save money down the road by investing in our families and our seniors today, because I think we're looking at the aging of population of Portland, and soon we'll have more people over 65 than under 18, which from a economic standpoint is going to be a challenge. And more than almost 50% of people that are retired live exclusively off of Social Security. So I'm advocating that we look at implementing a minimum basic income for Portland. Obviously, that's a big lift. That's something that culturally a lot of people don't understand per se. But I don't we're going to.
And financially, because that money's got to come from somewhere.
Correct. But when you think about all the money we're spending on homelessness and property crimes and addiction, that if we can link it to saving money, people will understand better. And more importantly, the lives of the kids in District 2, the families in District 2 will improve dramatically.
Mr. Semrel.
Yeah, I would pile on and agree with my colleagues here. I think that all of those things are right. Everyone in Portland, we've suffered in the last 4 years. We've got families moving out. We've got businesses leaving, which means taxes are going down and decreasing, which impacts our services that everybody wants and values. We're a highly taxed community.
Now, I just want to make sure the question is, what is the issue that you really care about? So when you pile on, when you say you're piling on, you're saying you agree with Mr. Marshall,
yes,
and Mr. Pass as being that being your main issue as well.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'll clarify. So I say, drugs off the streets, tents off the streets, addiction off the streets, and when I talk about compassion and care, I'm leaning heavily into we have the financial resources, hundreds of millions of dollars, and what's really frustrating is not being able to move the ball forward on these issues, and that's a skill set that I bring. So clean streets, drugs off the streets, but services provided, housing provided, and I have policies that that I'm crafting to help support those issues.
Mr. West.
Yeah, I mentioned at the outset that there's many things that the future of Portland will have, and so I agree with everything that's been said. I'll take another sort of a meta approach to this, that I think the most important issue that I'll work on, and I've already been, and we've all been working on it, is really setting up a new government in January. The charter reform was a series of paragraphs that leave out a lot of things. There's maybe a couple of sentences on committees and no information on how we're supposed to set them up, how we're supposed to perform oversight, how we're supposed to interact with the mayor, how we're supposed to do our work, how often we're supposed to meet. There's a huge number of unknowns. And unless we get the structure of communication and action correct, we won't be able to do anything.
You know, it's funny, though, because a lot of times that kind of flexibility is purposely open-ended, so that you can find a way to create something that is tailor-made.
Absolutely.
To exactly what you need, as opposed to having legislation where every sentence is, has every I dotted and every T crossed.
Right. I have no qualms with the way that the charter reform was written, that the new charter was written. It really does require elected leaders who have built things from scratch and who are collaborative and communicative. So that's something that we're going to have to do. There's whatever we choose to do over the next, let's say, 2 years, will be pretty much set for the next 20 or 40 or 80 years. So much of governing is norms and not rules that are inflexible for us to use.
Mr. Marshall, I saw your hand.
Yeah, I think what Nat's saying is true, but I think that is the exciting part of this, is we're going to be able to get in there and establish these things. The larger concern I have is the way the current city council is not funding this transition at the level it should. They've eliminated virtually all but one staff person. They've called into question whether we'll have district offices, which is a huge part of this, is reconnecting us and getting the people's elected officials back into the neighborhoods, talking to people, understanding their issues, and being more available and accessible. And so my larger concern is not so much that when 12 of us get elected, we can't figure it out, because that'll be the fun part and exciting part, and we'll have disagreements, but that'll be good. The larger part is that the die is already being set in terms of even the size of offices, putting a limit, the way they're doing the redesign, putting the limit on any future staff hires. And so, to me, that's a larger concern.
Mr. Pass, I also saw you nodding vigorously when Mr. West was talking.
Yes, I wanted to say I'm not clear on how much the current council can encumber a future council. And this happens on the school board all the time. I've been on the school board for about 5 years. I've been the first black chair of the school board and the current vice chair, voted in by my peers. What we see there is how we set policy and what we can encumber future boards to do. One example is in Oregon, school boards can pay stipends up to $500, but we cannot put that in place now for our own current board. We can vote on that benefit for future boards. But in most cases, we cannot encumber future boards.
So you're saying that needs to be something that does not apply to you as a potential counselor?
I would say that our incoming council has the ability to make the rules for themselves in terms of how they will proceed, including staffing, district offices. And again, I agree with what Mr. Marshall said, in that we do need to an element of community engagement with constituents. They're missing that touch with the city, that bridge, and in order to do that type of connecting, we will need to have offices near where people are that we're serving.
Okay. I want to touch on that for all four of you in a second, but May had a second question. Now, all of you have spoken about how you want to see these changes, and you've talked a little bit about some of the problems and how you think you might be able to overcome the problems. But May's other question, which has a star next to it, is how will you all be held accountable for the things that you promise? Mr. Pass, you first.
I love the question about accountability, and I agree with May 110%. In fact, the city of Portland does not have an office of measurement and evaluation, but the school district does, and that's where we track our progress against goals. So as a person coming in off the street to the city, we need to have goals, our policy goals, and we also need to evaluate whether those goals are successful or not, if we're meeting them or not. Are we actually serving the people that we're intending to? Are we aware of any unintended consequences? So yes, I think that right now we don't have a systems of accountability, and we actually absolutely need to build those out by tracking our own performance.
You know, when Mr. West was speaking about how it's very data-driven and there should be plenty of guidance based on research that's already been done of what needs to be done, I asked about political accountability and political will. So just because we have the data, I used to be in the military and I worked for the federal government, and there were plenty of reports that were done about how things could be done that stayed on the shelf. So, it really comes down not to the fact that the information is available, but does the information get actually applied?
Yes. Is it implemented? Is it I'll just give you an example. I work for the planning bureau.
Okay, quickly.
Yes. We've had the Albina plan. We've had the Interstate Corridor Urban Renewal Plan. We've had multiple plans in District 2. How well they're implemented has not been tracked and monitored.
Mr. Marshall, accountability.
So, a great question. Obviously, elections are the ultimate accountability, right? 4 years later, the voters have the opportunity to say, you did this or you didn't do this. And that's incumbent on us then as the incumbents to continually communicate with a level of transparency of what we're working on and what we're driving towards. And so doing community outreach, which the new council will have way more time to do that sort of thing, and that's why it was designed the way it was compared to the current commissioners. I do want to say, though, that accountability is also on the folks on the voters themselves. It's like democracy is a participatory institution. It's not once every 4 years. And so as we structure and we create and figure out what's best in terms of how to do outreach and the you know, town halls or community meetings or, you know, online surveys and stuff, it's really going to be incumbent on the public to give us continuing direction and feedback and passion relative to helping us prioritize.
There's an old cliche that people get the government they deserve.
Right.
Mr. Simrell.
Yeah, I think this is a great question. And I guess the way that I lean into it is when we convene in January, my priorities are around building what are referred to as KPIs or key performance indicators. And what I mean by that is we are going to have specific measurements for 88 nonprofits and 33 of the bureaus when they're consolidated, and we're going to have the managers of each of those organizations work with us collaboratively to identify those so that when we get to the new fiscal year, 25, we have a roadmap and a benchmark to start from and move forward to, and then we'll be able to identify where we're at. We don't have a starting point now. We've got to define that so that we can identify what success looks like, accountability looks like, and at the end of the day, when I think in terms of that, you know, from a perspective, there are some agencies that are doing well and some that aren't, but we don't have visibility to that. So we have to identify that benchmark and then move forward.
Mr. West, two questions ago, I asked you about data, and now we've circled back to you. So about accountability, what can you say about May's question?
Well, I think Bob did a fantastic job talking about data, so I'm going to take a little bit of a different answer to May's question. I think a lot of the complaints about lack of accountability comes from the way that our current government is structured. So we talked about the fact that there's three seats, there's four geographic districts, ranked choice voting. Sort of an underlying issue that not a lot of voters are aware of is that we're changing from a combined, from a commissioner form of government to a legislative and a separate executive form of government. And that might sound familiar to listeners. It's a radical idea, right? Everybody else doesn't. We haven't done it. And I think the current system of government is prone to on the edge of corruption, maybe lack of accountability for sure. It's very easy to circumvent the processes of the city.
I've heard it called five fiefdoms.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's so many anecdotes about how this is, you know, Mingus and Mapp's tearing out bike lanes on Southwest Broadway because a hotel person said, do this. You asked me to tear out a bike lane, I won't be able to do that. So I think the level of accountability automatically increases during the change of the government. But I also want to, you know, Mike mentioned the importance of community feedback. I think it's really critical that we don't just have an open door policy. That's how the current commissioners are doing their work. They're like, here it is, come on in if you want to talk to us. No, that's not going to work. We need to go through the door out into the community. It's important for us as councilors to go out to get the community information.
Yeah, and I want to really talk about that when we come back. You're listening to Running on Air, a production of KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host, Don Merrill. Today we're speaking with candidates from District 1. Those candidates are Nate West, Mike Marshall, Bob Simrell, and Michelle DePass. I encourage you to join the conversation by calling in your questions to the air room, 503-231-8187, or by messaging us on the KBOO website, kboo.fm. We'll be back after this break. All right, and you're listening to Running on Air, a production of KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host, Don Merrill. Today we're speaking with candidates from District 2. I have here with me Bob Simrell, Nat West, Michelle DePass, and Mike Marshall. Join the conversation by calling in your questions to the air room, 503-231-8187, or by messaging us on the KBOO website, kboo.fm. Let's get back to our discussion. Mr. West, before we went on break, you had talked about the importance of being able to interact with the community, but you said it wasn't going to be like the current council where there's an open door. But one of the reasons why the city is being restructured is to give residents in specific districts more of a say of what's happening in their district. So that means interactions are going to increase, mm-hmm. and they are going to tend to be messier because you now have 2.5 times more counselors, and you're going to be exposing that new council to a wider distribution of the city in general. So how are you going to keep it from not being an open door?
Oh, I'm not going to close the door for sure. There's a question of making sure that the three people who were elected in each district work well together. I think that's the most critical thing, to make sure that we are electing people who work well with others. The three seats, there's no hierarchy to them. They all have the same responsibilities, the same powers. I look forward to forming the extremely tight team. So you have to be able to bring people in who are very collaborative. I think that the Charter Reform Commission did a great job with the four different districts, because you don't want to ask me about what's happening on 82nd and Flavelle. Like, I know the area. I've driven a TriMet bus through the area, but I know what's going on MLK and Ainsworth and, you know, Fessenden. Those areas I know really, really well. And I think that's really what's exciting about so many of the candidates. We're bringing a career or a lifetime spent in a district, and we're not pretending like we know what's going on in other districts, as well as not pretending like we know what's going on in specialization areas outside of our background.
You bring up a really good point, because every team wants to have cohesion within that team. And if you look at the districts as teams, and you don't know what's going on in the other team, how do you make sure that the teams work together? Because if you got four districts, of course, each district has its own set of interests, its own set of goals.
Sure.
And how do you avoid the same kind of balkanization, more or less, that already exists? How are you going to avoid that in the future? Okay, Mr. Simmer.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I didn't want to. Yeah.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. And then Mr. Pass.
I just spoke.
So okay. No, that's great. So I actually put a little different spin on it, and I think that the problems in the city don't stop at the boundaries of the district. So while we focus on serving the communities and being focused on the areas of focus and outreach in our community, we do have to have a holistic approach to solving the problems. Otherwise, we're not going to move things forward, and then we will have conflict if we can't have alignment on what the priorities are for the city, as well as integrating the priorities from our individual districts.
Mr. Pass, do you agree with that?
I would say that I plan to have an empty office policy, and that is a step above open door, which puts the burden on constituents to come to us.
I get it. You're never going to be. You're going to go out all the time. Is that the idea?
No.
Sorry. Empty office.
I'm going to have an empty office policy, which means I will proactively go to community rather than putting the burden on them to come to me and knock on my door. So that's just me, and that's something I learned from a group of high schoolers recently. In terms of, yes, I think who said the our concern and care does not stop at the boundaries of District 2.
That was Mr. Simrell.
Mr. Simrell, we need to absolutely work with other districts, because the fire bureau, the police, water, and transportation have to do, it's our entire city we need to care about, and we need to be available to constituents in District 2. So I am not running to be, you know, this isn't the Michelle show. This would be the Michelle that's serving 160,000 and change residents in District 2 show. It is what they see. It's what they envision. And I want to work with constituents to get to craft that vision and then put it into action.
Okay, now I have to read an underwriting credit, but I see your hand up, Mr. Marshall. Okay. Support for Running on Air comes from KBOO members and the League of Women Voters. More information about the candidates on your ballot can be found on the League of Women Voters Portland website, lwvpdx.org. The League has videos of candidate interviews and forums, as well as links to candidates' written answers and explanations of ballot measure questions. That's lwvpdx.org. Mr. Marshall.
I think this is a great question, and it's one that we need to be concerned about relative to going to districts, which I think are the greatest thing that's happened to Portland in 150 years. But from my perspective, I'm going to be elected by the people of District 2 to do what's right for Portland. and not to just do what's right for District 2. And we've created a democracy culture across the country, particularly at the national level, where you go and you just represent your district. And you and so, for example, I live in Irvington, which is just beautiful and has a great tree canopy. It's 12 degrees cooler there than in East Portland or North Portland on any given hot day in the summer. And so I need to be focused and want to be focused on the fact that we need to get more trees in the, planted in the streets of East Portland and North Portland, which is in the district. So I think it's critical. The challenge that's going to be for constituents is that there's three of us elected per district. They've got a pothole they want filled. The great thing is now they have someone elected to go to as opposed to just calling the bureau. But who do they talk to? And so it's going to be incumbent on the teams in each district to figure that out so that we're not pointing to each other and say, oh, I'm not handling that, Michelle's handling that. There needs to be a way of me providing a solution to that person at the same time us all not spinning the wheel doing the, trying to do the same thing.
Okay. I wanted to shift gears a little bit. So I also did some research into each of your histories, and so I have a question for each of you about something that I found in your history that I want to ask you about. Mr. Simrall, I want to start with you. You used to work for a company called Sales Acceleration, and you were one of 12 vice presidents of sales that were hired back in 2018. And so I saw that there was some comments about the company, which were positive. I mean, all the reviews for Sales Acceleration were very good, considered a very good company as a training ground for sales executives. But I noticed that there was one comment from one of the executive vice presidents for sales from Michigan, and he said basically something along the lines of, the great thing about working for Sales Acceleration is you get to kill what you eat. And I remember thinking, now, I guess that when you're a salesperson, those kinds of attitudes are really important in business in order to achieve, in order to succeed. I mean, you know, that would be a comment I would expect that people would share like in a closed group, but it was on a public forum. So when you talk about, you know, bringing sort of your business acumen to city government, what kind of attitude do you expect that business acumen to transfer? How do you expect that to transfer to government? Because, of course, business is not government.
That's a great question. And Sales Acceleration was a good experience. It was a business consulting opportunity. So basically, I was a licensed consultant working with small businesses. My approach, and when I use this term and people think in terms of business, I actually think in terms of enterprise solutions and solving problems at scale. So when you are working across an organization that has 100,000 employees and you're trying to roll a product out to 192 countries and you don't have any direct reports, but you're accountable, you have to have planning, you have to have transparency, you have to be able to execute. And so those are the skills that I've learned in the enterprise world. I haven't only been in sales. I've run a wide range of different responsibilities and roles. I am not a kill what you eat person. That is a very short and narrow pathway to solving problems. I had my success in business by collaborating with folks, solving problems with folks, and looking long term at solutions. So I think that when we think in terms of that business background coming in, and you're right, the bureaucracy or the bureaus and the public government is not a business, but it is an enterprise. And that means it has 7,000 employees and $8 million. And we need to be more efficient with how we handle that. The last thing I'll say on the example, I know we were talking about adding additional resources for the city council. I wouldn't advocate that going into 25. I think we just go with what we got. We need to maintain the budget dollars are going to be down next year. I think we need to get our feet wet and just operate as efficiently as we can to get going.
So I wanted to shift to Mr. Marshall for a second. Now, Mr. Simrall emphasizes bringing an enterprise approach to government, you know, focusing on results-driven approaches and efficiency. Would it be accurate to say, Mr. Simrall, that you believe that your business background can provide unique advantages to reforming city government?
That's exactly why I'm leaning in. I think that having that skill set is sorely needed, and that's what folks are asking for. Like I said earlier, 75% of folks are frustrated with how we're using resources, and we can do much better.
Mr. Marshall, as opposed to that, you seem to be focusing on direct action and accountability. It seems like you want to leverage your experience for advocacy and recovery to drive concrete solutions. And your approach is rooted in more practical, experience-based solutions rather than enterprise-style efficiency. Is that right?
I think that's fair. I think our big challenge right now is that there's not a level of urgency within government to address the crises that are continually being declared. So we have a housing emergency that's been was called 6 years ago, but we're at 500. We're going to produce 500 new housing units this year, 6 years into the emergency, like the worst in history. We have an addiction crisis, and yet there's been no effort to increase detox, and we can't agree on a sobering center. So we need solutions that meet the moment, and they don't have to be permanent. They can be temporary. They don't have to be pretty. Maybe they're, you know, we shouldn't let perfection be the enemy of the good, but there just seems to be a lack of urgency at every level. What's the city or the county or even the state relative to the challenges we face? And I come out of a world of, you know, fighting for marriage equality, fighting to end the addiction crisis. I spent 5 years working overseas in emerging democracies. I'm all about let's get this stuff done, let's do it in a way that meets the magnitude of the problem.
Okay, and I wanted to talk a little bit about Mr. West and your approach. You talked about government structure. You strongly support the new city council structure. You think it'll help reduce the influence of money and allow for more equitable representation. And your views, based on your small business experience, you think are crucial for helping sort of bootstrap this new system.
Yes.
Okay. But Ms. DePass, now you don't explicitly address the new council structure per se, but your focus is more on long tenure in your various government roles and how this experience will aid you in effectively reshaping the existing framework. Is that right?
That's correct. And I would say to add to that yes, decision making in this publicly financed model looks very different from business. In business, if you are the owner of a company, you get to make decisions either unilaterally or in concert with your senior team. With this form of government, we will be making decisions by quorum, and that will depend, the results of those will depend on the ability of our colleagues to work together to compromise. But really, it's what our community is wanting of us and how we implement our community's visions.
You know, I was looking over all four of your experiences, and you all share a lot of similarities. I mean, Mr. West, Mr. Pass, you both advocate for strong representation of small businesses. You both are committed to an environment where, you know, business can thrive. You two also, you know, experience a lot of grassroots organizations. You know, you have extensive experience on the school board. And, you know, Mr. Simrow and Mr. Marshall, I mean, you both are advocates for holistic solutions for homelessness. You prioritize addressing addiction issues. If you don't get elected for the seats that you're running for, do you hope that Portlanders will pick people, will continue to move in this progressive direction, even if you're not the one that they end up electing, Ms. DePass?
Absolutely. And I'm not going to show up any different than I have for the last 30 years since I've chosen to live back in Portland, you know, as a young adult to be back with my family. But absolutely, I haven't really given a lot of thought to Plan B, but I will absolutely show up. I care about this community. I really care about Albina. There's about a $900 million investment in Albina right now that I want to be a part of. I want to help drive.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that. Talk a little
sure.
about
so,
your passion for Albina.
My passion for Albina, where I was born and raised, where my dad emigrated from Panama. My dad and mother met the first day my dad set foot in this country at Dawson Park. And I live within walking distance of Dawson Park. So I have a deep love and appreciation for the Black community that was there, a deep understanding of the gentrification that has plagued that district, who has done the speaking in that district for the last 60 years, and want to be a part of the change that will happen there.
Speaking of who can speak for who, I wanted to ask Mr. West a question. So, Mr. West, I was looking at an interview that you did with Bike Portland, and you said something that really got my attention. You said, "I'm not scared of fights at all. I'm not scared of sticking my white skin in a place where it's much better to have a white guy saying these things than it is to have a Black guy saying these things. I'm really comfortable with that." So could you explain that a little bit?
Sure. I spent 12 years running Reverend Nat's Hard Cider, and during that time, I found myself regularly in situations where I was supporting grassroots organizations and with donations primarily, and I'd look around, and I'd be the only local business, small business, who was supporting the critical work of these really important community groups. I was saddened by that, but I was not. It made me want to participate more in the community. You know, one thing led to another, I guess. And you know, come 2020, like a lot of Portlanders, like tens of thousands of Portlanders, we all showed up in the streets to demand police accountability. And I had a challenging experience one night where both me and my kid were injured by a federal officer, and it was challenging for us.
It sounds like it was challenging.
We came away from that with a realization that, you know, that injury would have happened to someone else if we hadn't been standing there. And, you know, we had health insurance, and I had a flexible job, and we were capable of taking that hit. And that reinforced the importance of using the power and the privilege that each of us have, and I have a lot more power and privilege than a lot of people, to stand up for people who shouldn't be there, that shouldn't be taking that hit, and to really do a bunch of work on other people's behalf. So my wife asked me early on, she said, why are you running? And I realized that I have a responsibility to the community. A lot of people know me, and this is something that I can do to protect other people who don't feel comfortable coming into, you know, running for office. I can speak for them.
Okay, so what I hear you saying is that, I'll hold that. Mr. Pass, you first, and then you, Mr. Marshall.
Thank you. So I had a little bit of a reaction to I can speak for them. Having, 60 years off and on experience in the community, we've had lots of spokespeople that have never resulted in anything positive in terms of who owns land, the home ownership, the loss of generational wealth, the loss of Black churches, community, businesses all along Williams, along Union Avenue. And so when I hear someone saying they can speak for me or speak for others, I'm sensitive to it, having experienced the very downsides of not speaking for myself. So I always show up for myself, humble, understanding I don't have the power to speak for other people, especially as a Black woman. I would never assume I could speak and represent other people.
Mr. Marshall.
Thanks, Michelle, for that. I think this reminds me of a situation when I first co-founded Oregon Recovers, and we were talking to different folks within the community, and one of the people we went to was runs the African American Outreach Program at Central City Concern. And coming out as a person in recovery is very hard. Alcoholics Anonymous, 12 steps. Anonymous has been the defining characteristic of recovery. You're not supposed to talk about it. But in recent years, we've realized that we can't end the addiction crisis if we don't have people with lived experience saying out loud that, in fact, that's what they're sharing their own journey. And what this when I was there with a colleague of mine who's also a white man, and talking with this African American woman, telling her about our vision for Oregon Recovers, and she said, "You guys, it's great. I'm 100% supportive, but just understand that as a white person, you have the privilege, Mike, to stand up in front of a room and say you're in recovery, and everyone applauds. But if someone who looks like Bob stands up there, they may think of him as a former drug addict, not a person in recovery. Language matters, perception matters." And so I didn't take that as sit down, don't do this. I took this as recognize your own privilege, which I think is what Nat was saying, and leverage it, use it, but be conscious of, like, when you're asking people to come out of the closet as a person in recovery, there are consequences to that. Whether you're a person of color or you're 25 years old and trying to build your career at Nike, you have to be careful about that because it's so highly stigmatized. And it's true of being a gay man as well and being involved in the marriage equality movement first in the late 90s. Communities of color, homophobia was really prevalent, particularly in the churches. And so I had economic privilege. I had white privilege. I lived in San Francisco. There were plenty of folks that the stigma of being gay, so they couldn't come out. And those are often along socioeconomic lines, right? And so I guess I'm trying to sort of stress what Nat was saying, which is when you have privilege, don't let that cow you from not doing the right thing, but walk through life being really conscious of what it is.
Mr. Simrell.
Yeah, I think, first of all, I think Nat's intentions are spot on, you know, and as a person of mixed race, a black man with a white mom, coming from the projects and also having success and being able to provide my next generation and my three kids are going on to college, when I look at our district, and you'll hear a lot about, you know, what's happening in Albina in the African-American community, which I love and embrace as well. I don't have the history with it that Michelle has. But we also have to recognize that 15% of District 2 is Hispanic. 10% is African-American. And so my outreach has been also intentional going into the Hispanic and Latin communities and understanding their needs as well as everyone. So I have a personal background, social background, and experience to reach 160,000 constituents in this community and listen to them. And I have access. I can walk into Peninsula Park and walk up to someone who is kind of an angry, you know, black woman who's got frustration and rightfully so. And my answer would be, you remind me of my Aunt Bobby. And so let's have that conversation.
Yeah, let's continue to have that conversation, Mr. Pass.
That also got a huge reaction from me just to hear the words angry black woman. It's so personally insulting right now. I do need to leave early. I'm also Hispanic. I want to let you know my family's from Panama. Nosotros hablamos español. And I went to school in Caracas and in Guadalajara growing up. So I'm both. I'm a black Hispanic person, and I understand the population triangle and demographic profile.
Well, Mr. Pass, I know that you have to leave, but is there anything that you want to leave us with?
I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I really appreciate the research that you put into understanding who we are. It's been great being with all of you and hearing a little bit about you. I want to leave people with my love for Portland, my hope for a better future, my very strong advocacy for an age-friendly city, which we adopted in 2006. We've let that fall by the wayside, but I really think looking at policy through an age spectrum, age-friendliness, a World Health Organization framework will set us on the path to working at the most vulnerable ends of our community, okay. That population triangle that you referenced earlier.
Okay. Thank you very
much. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here, Mr. Pass. Okay. So, gentlemen, for the remainder of the time, we've got a couple of minutes left. So is there any closing thoughts that each of you would like to leave before we close out? Mr. Marshall, go ahead.
So many of us in Portland are frustrated with the way life has changed significantly in the last few years. But I want to say that all of these different issues are solvable. And we have a new opportunity to bring in a responsive government under this new structure that's going to be about problem solving and also creating a vision for Portland into the future. Once we get beyond the current issues around, try to get beyond the current issues around housing and addiction and mental health. And so I hope that people will be really optimistic about this election. And I realize it's a new voting system and you vote for six and three get elected. It's ranked choice voting. But it's exciting. We are once again leading the country in yet another way in terms of our democratic reform. And so I hope people will lean in, check out everybody's websites. Mine is MikeMarshallForPortland.com. I'm completely optimistic about the future of Portland, and I would love to have the support of all the voters in District 2.
Mr. Simrell.
Yes. First of all, I want to apologize to Mr. Pass. I did not mean anything insulting by my comment and was just trying to express an experience that I had as a person of color. The thing that I would love to ask for the city of Portland is as you look to diversify, when we go to 12 folks on the council, we need to diversify the folks that are representing on that council. So it's not, in my opinion, don't look at, a specific qualification or skill set that may kind of have us where we are today. We have an opportunity to reshift our thinking and move forward. So I think Matt mentioned it earlier, look at it as a team of 12 folks with diversified skills and backgrounds, and bring that together as you look to make your decisions in November.
And Mr. West, very quickly.
I have learned so much from these candidates, including the ones who are not here, and it's really a fantastic opportunity for us all to become better candidates along the way. You mentioned earlier what might we do if we don't win. I'd be remiss if I didn't say that I was a TriMet bus driver for 8 months, and that was a truly educational moment for me. So learning is absolutely in my blood, and I'm a better person now for having gone through this.
Thank you. Michelle DePass, Bob Simrell, Mike Marshall, Nate West, thank you all for joining us. You've been listening to Running on Air, produced at KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. You can find all of the episodes of Running on Air on the KBOO website. That's KBOO.fm/runningonair. Episodes are also available wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you to all KBOO volunteers who helped make this happen. Our engineers are Bob Davis and Arthur Rizzuto. Our producer is Althea Billings, and our editor is Eric Luschner. Tune in for the next episode of Running on Air. It'll be with candidates from District 3 at 10 a.m. tomorrow, Wednesday, September 11th. I'm your host, Don Merrill. Thanks for listening.